Tonight on Arena, we review Roddy Doyle's new novel, The Women Behind the Door, and the director of His Three Daughters, starring Carrie Coon, Elizabeth Olsen and Natasha Lyonne. #51551 is the text. You can tweet the programme at RTE Arena. Roddy Doyle returns to one of his best loved creations in his new novel, The Women Behind the Door. Yes, Paula Spencer is back 30 years after she first appeared on our TV screens in the shocking and acclaimed series Family. Paula was married to Charlo then, mother of their four children, a woman who liked to drink and who found herself often on the receiving end of her husband's fists. Doyle subsequently wrote two novels about Paula, The Woman Who Walked Into Doors in 1996 and Paula Spencer in 2006. In this new book, Paula is 66 and in a much better place. COVID, however, brings challenges, but she has a job she likes at a dry cleaner's. A new man in her life and she's off the drink. Then her eldest daughter, Nicola, turns up on her doorstep in all kinds of turmoil. Mary McGill has been reading The Women Behind the Door and she joins me now to talk more about it. This character, Mary, of Roddy Doyle's, Paula Spencer, it seems like a character that has, maybe haunted isn't the right word, but that has been very much part of his imagination right from that creation of the character by Ger Ryan in the television series, the TV series back in 1994, Family.
Yes, and it was a bit of a departure for Roddy Doyle, who wrote Family. It was an RTE and BBC co-production. And so he was obviously very famous at this stage, Sean, for the Barrytown trilogy. And we had this absolutely hilarious and very warm working class family called the Rabbits in this trilogy. And that's really what he was associated with, and that's what he was most famous for. The Spencers are, in many respects, the anti-Rabbits.
Yeah.
These are a group of very complicated individuals. You mentioned Charlo there, who is the patriarch. You mentioned Paula Spencer, played by Ger Ryan in Family, who's the matriarch. And this is an Ireland that the Roddy Doyle is writing about in 1994. I think this is important context to give it. It's an Ireland in which divorce is still illegal. It's an Ireland in which marital rape has only been made illegal in 1990. It's an Ireland in which actually outlawing domestic violence is less than 20 years old. It's an Ireland where the Celtic Tiger hasn't even begun to roar yet. So it's a very difficult and darker version of storytelling than what we would have initially associated Roddy Doyle with in Family. And when the show is initially aired, there is huge backlash to it because of its depiction of this darker side of Irish family life.
Yeah, and in fact, I was listening to some of the conversation that Oliver Callan had with Roddy Doyle this morning, and they played clips from Morning Ireland and from The Late Late Show. Well worth listening back to all of that. And some of the reactions are quite extraordinary. The idea, first of all, of domestic violence like that doesn't happen. You'd need to set it in England if you wanted to do something like that.
It's astonishing to listen to those testimonies now from ordinary people. But I think what's very striking about those old recordings is that you hear some women, calling for, careful now and down with this sort of thing. But you also hear a lot of women going, actually, this is true. That Roddy Doyle is writing about an Ireland that I know, unfortunately, or that I know other women in my life know, unfortunately. And it was one of those moments in the 90s, and there were very many of them, Sean. I mean, we're just 2 years on here, 1992, Sinead O'Connor tearing up the picture of the Pope, and we've got all the reports coming out, religious institutions and so on. Family was one of those big watershed moments that held a mirror up to Irish life and said, who are we, what are we, and why do we tolerate these things? And it's, started a conversation that remains ongoing. And I think that is part of the reason why Paula Spencer as a character has become so beloved and so enduring.
Yeah, and again, I was reading, I think, one of the early reviews of the first novel that came out of Family then. We should say also that Charlo was played by Sean McGinley absolutely brilliantly in that TV series. The gentlest man in the world in real life, and he played this absolute monster, Charlo, in Family. However, the novel then having written the four-part series from the point of view of the of Paula, of Charlo, and of the two children, or two of the children, John Paul and Nicola, and the John Paul thing is so beautiful there, because children in the 90s, who, you know, were often named after Pope John Paul, who had visited the country.
Yep.
It tells part of that social history as well. But he then decided to mine a novel out of that. And it's not just a retelling of that story. It really pursues the voice and the point of view of Paula Spencer, The Woman Who Walked Into Doors, was the novel.
Yes, and this, and what is so, I think, so captivating about Paula is that she is a survivor, and she does have this terrible life with Charlo, and she does things through alcoholism that she absolutely regrets. And that is a theme that, you know, was carried through to the book that we're talking about tonight. But this sense of the woman who walked into doors, you know, Paula as a survivor, Paula as somebody who in many ways can't even recognize her own capacity for endurance and strength. And I think part of the reason that she resonates through these novels, and I think, you know, through Ireland culturally, is because there are thousands of Paulas across this country in various capacities who kind of hold things together even as they fall apart. And, you know, The Woman Who Walked Into Doors, I mean, even that, the title refers to her trying to take responsibility for the fact that her husband has beaten her up, and she's saying, oh, no, I've just walked into doors. That's what these bruises are all about. You know, still trying to hold it together in the midst of her own suffering. So, yeah, that is the power of Paula Spencer.
And I mean, it obviously those are the early parts of Family and The Woman Who Walked Into Doors. Very dark stories are being told within them. Yet I was surprised to hear Roddy Doyle say this morning that in fact in Family we never see Charlo hit Paula, yet the violence is so present all of the time, or maybe the threat of violence is there.
Yes, and I wonder what that's. It's funny as well, when you listen to people talking about Family, it's almost as if, Sean, they think they have seen her being hit, right? They think that they have seen Paula Spencer being hit, but as you say in the TV show, they haven't. So I think that actually says something about people's experiences of violence in Ireland. Like, they can sense it. They're very acute. They're hyper responsive to it. They don't necessarily need to see it to know that it's there and to know that it's implied. And I think culturally, again, what does that, looking back now to those watershed moments of the 90s, you're kind of thinking to yourself, well, as a nation, it's hardly surprising that we would have those kind of antennas given our own history. And it's, you know, it's a history that still makes a lot of people very, very uncomfortable. And I think Paula, in a sense, Paula has grown with the peeling back of those layers to the point where she is now in her 60s and just beginning to enjoy life until COVID comes along.
And just before we go on to that, another point that I wanted to make about the earlier novel, The Woman Who Walked Into Doors, the very first of the trilogy, the New York Times review talked about the fact that Paula becomes, she frees herself from being a battered wife when she becomes a responsive mother. The task that she had to get rid of Charlo out of the house, to look after her children, and in so doing, that's how she freed herself. I mean, with the eyes of 2024, you say, well, of course she did that. Wasn't that straightforward in 1994?
No, Sean, and it is that moment that haunts this most recent novel, The Women Behind the Door, because the child that tipped her over the edge, the child that became the line in the sand as far as Charlo is concerned, is Nicola, her eldest daughter. I won't give too much away about what causes that moment in case people haven't read the books. It's an important one, and it sets everything in context. But that is the line in the sand, and that is what makes Paula Spencer pick up that frying pan, bash Charlo over the head, and effectively eject him from her life and the life of her children. But again, Sean, if only it were that simple, because even, you know, when we return now to this new book, Charlo is dead, but he's in many respects not quite buried.
Ever present. And the in-between novel, I suppose, the Paula Spencer, which is the simple novel, the simple name on the middle novel here. It's interesting, though, again, I heard Roddy saying, oh, it was the only name I could come up with. But she is the woman who walked into doors in the first novel, but she has a name. She has a person who has established her own identity by the end of that second novel.
Yes, in that second novel, it's where she makes that definitive break. And part of what she is breaking with is the violence that has coloured her life with Charlo up until this point. And also, I think it's her taking responsibility for herself. And then, as you say, by taking responsibility for herself, that enables her to take responsibility for the well-being of her children as well.
Now we're into a title that suggests, again, that things have to be hidden and kept secret. The women behind the door. And you've touched on it there, Mary. Mary McGill speaking with us about Roddy Doyle's new novel, The Women Behind the Door, this evening. We're reviewing it here in Arena. That novel, this new novel, brings us right up to date. We're in the middle of the pandemic, and Nicola, the daughter, who is hugely successful in her life, it seems, comes to Mammy's door.
She comes to Mammy's door, and this is a bit of a shock for Paula Spencer, because she regards Nicola as probably her greatest work, her greatest triumph. She says, you know, at her lowest ebb, Paula can look at Nicola and think to herself, not everything's been a disaster. And yet here is Nicola on her doorstep, as you say, looking to move back into the family home, which is a site of complicated memories for Paula and for Nicola, and effectively walking out on what Paula regards as kind of like a dream situation, a nice husband, lovely daughters, great career, so on and so forth. And COVID, conveniently enough, provides a cover for all of this, because they can say that they're ill and that they're isolating together. So they have these 10 concentrated days to hash out why it is that Nicola has reached this point in her life, and to kind of reckon with the complicated past that they have both endured in that house, largely because of the long shadow of Charlo and his impact on Paula and on Nicola.
And it's a touch of brilliance from Roddy Doyle that he finds, and he's very specific about dates here and the number of kilometres you can walk away from your house, all of the above. But it's a touch of genius to choose that period to set this novel in, because of necessity, mother and daughter are in the house together. There's also a little bit of lying going on here, a little bit of a cover up.
Absolutely. And I think in a way there's kind of been, a lot of people haven't as yet tackled the lockdown period head on. You know, there's kind of been a shying away from it a bit in fiction. But I love that Doyle has got really stuck in there, and he's made it work for him. And then in a way you kind of go, well, of course he has, because he is the master of the domestic. This is his sphere. You know, we were all shunted back into our homes during the pandemic, and from that he weaves this, I have to say, at times quite claustrophobic. It was strange to be reminded of how kind of disorientating it all was. But at the same time, in terms of setting the stage for Nicola and for Paula to have this connection and to really dig into their experiences, you could have no better scenario than this. And he really, really makes it work.
Again, you don't want to go into the specifics and any of the details of the story that's told here, but essentially I don't think it doesn't take a huge imagination to work out that we're dealing with intergenerational trauma here.
We are. And we're dealing with, you know, Paula, she acknowledges that she will always be an addict, and she, you know, acknowledges the role that alcohol has played in her life. But there are things that still stop her in her steps. And Nicola is her, when she thinks back to the ways that she let Nicola down while she was an alcoholic and while Charlo was still in the house, this is one of them. So she can remember, you know, Nicola wiping up her vomit and her blood. She can remember one birthday of Nicola's, when she was a teenager and she got her a bottle of vodka. You know, things that still just, she will never be able to make her peace with them, because she is so guilty and so ashamed. And there's also shown a lot of things that they haven't talked about, and there's things that Paula doesn't know because she wasn't present in the way that she should have been, because of her own suffering and because of her alcoholism. So yes, there's this notion of the door, of things been shut down, things been locked out. I think that's a really strong metaphor throughout this book as well.
Yeah, and again, it's the women behind the door. The women are forced into the situation of either hiding themselves away or keeping these secrets. And by the way, if this question gives anything away, just don't answer it and tell me you're not telling me. I'm just wondering.
Fair
enough. I'm wondering about the other members of the family, in particular John Paul, played by the then very young Barry Ward, but a very different actor now obviously than he was back then. Do we hear much about the rest of the family and how, where they are and what they're up to?
I won't say anything that will give anything away, but they have all flown the nest,
right?
And I think that Paula is quite impressed with how well they are all doing. So again, this makes Nicola's arrival on her doorstep all the more surprising, because out of all of the kids, It is not Nicola that you would be expecting to see on her doorstep.
Yeah, yeah, okay. You've whetted my appetite even more now. what we've spoken about Women Behind the Door is, up to this point, how dark it is, you know, and all of this very difficult material that is dealt with. However, Paula Spencer is in a very good place now, and there are very humorous and wonderfully happy parts of her life that we get on the page as well, I believe.
It is absolutely gas, John. Like, when this book is funny, it is Roddy Doyle at his most masterful when it comes to capturing the colour and language of working class Dublin. The book opens with Paula and her best pal Mary, who's also hilarious, going to get their vaccine at the Helix in Dublin. And this is like a bizarre day out for them, and they are milking it for all it's worth. And I won't even begin to try and attempt and, you know, reproduce those jokes here, because I won't do them justice. But honestly, these are two women I could spend, revel in their company, because they're so, so funny. I have to say, I did find, I think, reading passages, I was like, is there another Roddy Doyle play between Mary and Paula? Mm-hmm. I could see it. It would be a great night out. I'd let, you know, people would laugh their backsides off. So I think it's very important to point out that, yes, emotionally, this is a very weighty novel, but that wonderful humour that Roddy Doyle is known for is all over it as well. And it can come, I have to say, when you're least expecting it. So those moments of lightness and darkness are right beside each other, and it can turn in the flip of a coin, you know, which is a lot of fun for a reader.
Is there anything in this novel that you would say this could be better, or I wouldn't bother with that section of it, because what you've been saying so far is phenomenally positive?
It's definitely a very enjoyable read if you are a fan of Paula Spencer and you are invested in finding out what Paula does next. There's no shortage of detail with regard to that. But I think maybe the level of detail and the level of interiority might put some people off if they are not familiar with the character, or if they find the whole kind of evoking of that lockdown period a bit overly claustrophobic, or they're just not, you know, it's just not something, that kind of feeling is not something they want to return to. I could definitely see people being resistant to that. But I think for fans of Paula Spencer, they will be delighted and charmed by this.
Well, if you're not a fan, surely you should go back and read The Woman Who Walked Into Doors, Paula Spencer, and then you'll be all set up for the trilogy, for the final book. But you can read the final book as a total standalone. You don't need, there's enough background given, I'm guessing, Mary, to just go straight into it.
I mean, there is, but I think you would probably benefit from being familiar with the early work. And no harm watching Family as well, sure.
It's available on DVD, and I know there's all people. I'd be looking for a 30th anniversary repeat of that on the telly. And as you say, maybe there's a follow-up now in terms of the Mary and Paula characters. And did you see Paula and Nicola and Ger Ryan? And Nellie Conroy could reprieve those parts, I'm sure. They'd be dead right.
It'd be amazing.
Mary, thanks so much for being with us this evening.
Thanks, Sean.
That's Mary McGill, and she's been speaking to us about The Women Behind the Door by Roddy Doyle. It's published by Jonathan Cape. You're listening to Tuesday Night's Arena. In Azazel Jacob's new feature film, three sisters gather in their childhood home in Lower Manhattan as their father lies dying. As these very different women come to terms with what's happening, decades-old resentments, rows and rivalries inevitably rekindle. The sisters are played by renowned actors. Carrie Coon is Katie, an uptight and under-pressure New York mom. Elizabeth Olsen plays Christina, a more free-spirited personality for sure, but still adjusting to early motherhood. And Natasha Lyonne is Rachel, stepsister to the other two and a sports betting stoner who's still living at home. Azazel Jacobs wrote the script for his three daughters with these three performers specifically in mind, but also with an eye to his own experiences of loss. I spoke to the filmmaker, Azazel Jacobs, recently about his three daughters. That's the film. But before I bring you that conversation, let's have a listen to Elizabeth Olsen, Natasha Lyonne and Carrie Coon in action.
It's nice that it's us, just us. This is the way it should be, the way he would want it. I interrupted something. I'm sorry. How are you, Rachel? I feel like we haven't spoken since Thanksgiving. How are you?
I'm all good. I don't know what you want me to say. I'm good. That's basically it.
Well, she's definitely high. The whole place stinks like weed.
Fuck yeah, I'm high. First thing I do in the morning is I roll a blunt. Then I smoke at least three more throughout the day. You know why? Because that's how I do shit.
I don't care that you smoke weed. It's just not right to smoke it in the house when someone is sick.
My daddy doesn't mind. Trust me, I've been smoking around him all this time, and he never had an issue. In fact, he likes the smell. Told me more than a few times.
It's the smoke. The smoke, not the smell. The man is dying. Just go outside.
Damn, it took you 5 minutes. 5 minutes, right? To just get in my shit. A second ago, it was how let's just get along.
Yes. Yes. Let's settle down. There's no reason for this to become an issue.
And for her, just take her shitty weed and smoke it outside.
Shitty weed? Oh, please. Now, I get top shelf. Not that dog shit you smoked all day long, right? You think I forgot that?
That was high school. I've grown up quite a lot since then, unlike others.
Grown up? Still a bitch.
Rachel, Katie, no. Let's just stop.
Director of His Three Daughters, Azazel Jacobs, welcome to Arena. Thank you for a very moving and wonderful film that you've given to us, Azazel. You wrote this for quite a cast. Natasha Lyonne, Elizabeth Olsen and Carrie Coon as the three sisters, the three daughters of the title of the film. How did you come up with those three in your mind, and how did they then shape the characters you created?
Well, first off, thank you for speaking with me. I wrote with them first. I was a fan of their work, and I kind of had a sense of their rhythm, just in terms of their rhythm as performers, as their voice, and had a sense of what the tone of their voices were. And what dictated the writing of this more than anything was the rhythm and the sound, the kind of idea of the conflicts that could happen with such disparate characters coming from different ways, all trapped under one place. So it was really getting a sense of their rhythms that made me think of them and then pursue them. That was what first and foremost jumped out about them, as you know, the great performers they are, that they would bring that to this story.
It is a brave way to go about things in some ways, because you then have to explain to Natasha Lyonne, you're the kind of the flaky one here, Natasha. You have to explain to Carrie Coon, you're the totally controlling one. And I'm talking about their characters here. And then you have to explain to Elizabeth Olsen, and you're sort of stuck in the middle and you're a little bit at sea with some things. How did you feel about presenting them with those characters? As I know you weren't saying versions of themselves, but certainly something that you saw within them.
Yeah, it is an uncomfortable thing to say to someone that you've written this with them in mind, because it's like, who am I to say that? Like, I'm more than anything just knowing them from their work. But I got the sense that A, they would know these types, and B, that they would be willing to really go someplace else with these types, because so much of what this story is about is the way that the sisters are performing for each other. They're playing, especially in the beginning of the film, that they're presenting themselves the way that they think that they're supposed to be with each other, who they think they are to each other. And so I think me explaining that's like, yes, these are, especially in the beginning, starting off as caricatures of like types of variations of maybe either characters, people that you know or people that you may have played in the past. By the end of the film, we're going to have gone, hopefully, to someplace very different, and where they're going to unravel and show themselves to be, you know, quite different than the way they initially appear.
Yeah, they are very guarded, one would have to say, in those performative roles in the beginning of the film. The characters, that is, are very guarded in what they will say. They're covering up quite a lot, I think, all three of them, some more than others. When you in the writing of the characters, how much did you know they were hiding, or did that kind of begin to reveal itself as you wrote?
Truly revealed itself as they wrote. It was I started off with this big monologue that Carrie Coon delivers as Katie, just kind of laying in to her sister, you know, for not taking care of this thing or taking care of that. In a kind of very, very passive aggressive way.
Being there for him, being here. Things from the past don't matter, not right now. If there are things to work out, they can wait. I really hope you agree. I'm upset. I know you are too. We all are. It's hard. It sucks. Let's not make it harder, okay? I did see that the DNR never got signed like I asked quite a few times. I got it. It's not that easy. Well, it was easy, actually. Now it's a lot harder. I'm not making this a thing. I'm just saying it's harder now that he's not seeing doctors. I have to figure out how to get Dr. Sanders here or someone who can witness his signature, and it would have been just a lot simpler when you were taking him in. And I don't know how much time I have. He has. It's important. It's really important.
And it raised questions. It felt so much of this writing felt like transcribing, and I really wrote it forward, meaning like one scene to the next, and they started revealing themselves along with some of the things that happened later on. They were, felt like surprises to me, but then it made sense. Like it was like, oh, okay, so that's why the sister is being this way to that person, because she sees that. But meanwhile, we're seeing something else because we have, we are privy to them when they're not with around each other and see these other sides of them before they do for each other.
It also would seem that that way of writing fed into the way that you shot the film over 18 days. I mean, that's a very tight schedule, but it's very contained, most of it within an apartment, but shot over 18 days and shot on film. And I should also say, I believe you sent the scripts to all three actors involved on paper. You didn't send it digitally. So were you in an old school frame of mind?
I was. I missed those films. I missed that type of filmmaking that I felt like I saw quite a lot in the 90s, when these personal stories where the stakes were very high, but they're also stakes that all of us can experience in our own lives that were relatable. Like I wanted to try to make a film in that way that just kind of approached it, which is, hey, this will be our film. That it's gonna be as handmade as possible, but it's gonna be ours, and it's not really gonna have any outside influences or outside reasons to be made. And so that was a way, me printing it out was like kind of like a signal, hey, this is shouldn't just fit in with the other emails. I want you to step away for a moment and see what I'm proposing here, which was somewhat off the grid type of filmmaking that used to be much more prevalent at one point.
As I say, the most of the action of his three daughters takes place in the apartment where the father is, you know, in his final days and in his final moments, in a bedroom that we don't go into. We spend the time in the other rooms of the apartment with the three daughters, the three sisters. How claustrophobic was that? And claustrophobia can also lead to intimacy as well as tensions. How did that feed into what happened on set?
Well, one of the great things about the size of this film being as small as it was is that we were able to shoot the film in order because it was also in one location. So it built as we got to know each other, as we got each other's rhythms, as the actors got to really, I mean, I would say from the moment on that they really kind of fell in sync and luckily and amazingly all very connected very quickly. But in real time, as the characters are going through, we're also going through something similar, which is we're seeing the end of the film, the filmmaking approaching, get closer and closer, and what all those feelings of going, wow, we're in a period together, we're holding on, we're actually having a lot of fun, but we also know that this is coming to an end, and that naturally also kind of forces a sort of distance. I think one of the things that at least me and the cinematographer Sam Levy and I try to do was to unveil the apartment in piecemeal way, in the way that the characters are slowly revealed to be something else than what you've pictured. So that helped with the claustrophobia, and just in terms of that meant us moving to different spaces in the apartment that we hadn't worked in yet. And so it kind of felt like the lights would change or whatever we were doing, where our positions would change. So it felt new for quite a long time until you really got the layout of the place, and then that claustrophobia was part of the story.
The other thing that's been dealt with here is the death of the father and three, adult children dealing with that death and all of the dynamics of that particular experience. I think you had cared for your own parents. How did that feed into the what you wrote about and that universal experience, really, for many people, either losing a parent or watching their own parents dealing with the deaths of their parents?
I think the thing that really confused me the most about it was like, this is the best case scenario, that you outlive your parents and this is the natural thing. And it felt so unnatural, the whole experience. So this was a way for me to get my head around it, but also you know, to get some type of control and take this thing that I love doing, filmmaking, and bring it into this world of something that was kind of has had so much pain and felt so out of control. So it was as close as can be and as personal a story as can be. But I'm one of those people that come with the belief that if you can be really precise with things, that it'll mean it'll be more universal and hopefully more people will connect and relate to it.
It also, that universality leads to a film that is very moving in places. How emotional a set was it? There's one particular scene, I don't want to give too much away, where a character is being moved. Hugely technical scene where all sorts of things have to be taken into account. Three people moving one person, putting them into a seat and all kinds of things involved in that. Yet that was the scene where I blubbered helplessly watching it. I'm kind of wondering about the dynamic of that on set.
Yeah, I mean, it was, and again, because, you know, that came when we were shooting that came at the close to the time that scene happens, just in terms of like in the process of shooting. So we had built up a certain rhythm that got broken once bringing in this other, you know, person that was exhilarating and terrifying and scary. We had fallen into a certain comfortable pattern by that point of understanding how things work. And here is another person coming in that's really changing things up and flipping them down in ways that we had to absorb and then reflect in some way. But it was exhilarating. I mean, that's the thing about the making of this film, that I'm really touched when people find it moving, and I found it moving shooting it. But I also like had so much fun making this film, and I'm hoping that translates as well, because it was a completely joyful experience, the actual making of the film.
Azazel Jacobs, director of his three daughters. Thanks so much for being with us on Arena, Azazel.
Thank you so much. Really appreciate it.
How are you? I know this can't be easy, having Katie and I invade your space the way we have.
It's not my space.
No, well, it is. I mean, it's Dad's and yours, but you know, soon it will be yours. I'm planning on getting my storage out either in the garbage or back home with me. I'm sorry I left things in there as long as I have. I won't leave you with that.
I don't care. It's not in my room, not my business.
Well, I do. And I'm just saying there's no reason for it to stay there. I have plenty of space. Too much space. I guess enough for another child when the time comes, but Mirabelle's a handful as it is, you know. It's hard to imagine, too, but they say it gets easier. That's what they say, at least. I know David's ready. What about you?
What about me?
Kids. Do you want children?
I'm sorry, but you're crazy. No offense, just kind of nuts.
I am.
And that was Elizabeth Olsen and Natasha Lyonne there in a scene from Azazel Jacobs' new feature film, His Three Daughters, which is available on Netflix from tomorrow. Now, the childhood of Jesus, the school days of Jesus, and the death of Jesus make up a set of novels many fans of J.M. Coetzee regard as his masterpiece. In this trilogy, the South African Nobel laureate and double Booker Prize winner follows the journey of a middle-aged man, Simon, and a young boy, David, as they arrive at a strange city after an epic journey across the ocean. Director Annabel Cumming and writer Owen Quinn have adapted the books for the stage for the Dublin Theatre Festival. The Jesus Trilogy features Malcolm Adams, Colin Campbell, Fergal McElherin, Tiara Porter and Raymond Scannell, among others in the cast. Delighted that Annabel and Fergal are with me in studio this evening. The trilogy itself, first of all, Annabel, because I think you kind of ate these books when they first came out. What attracted you to what Coetzee does in this trilogy? And when did you start thinking, this is something for the stage?
Hello, and thanks for having us on. Yeah, I read the first one when it came out. So I think it came out, 12, 13, something
like
that.
Yeah, 2013, I think.
Yeah, years ago. And I read that. I was on holiday in the west of Ireland and I just saw it in the bookshop and thought, I'll read that. I read Disgrace years ago. Mm. And then I read each one as they came out. And maybe after the second one, which is set in the dance academy, I went, oh, that's really interesting. And just some of the ideas he's exploring in that. And by the time I'd read the final one, I suppose I just had a curiosity about them. And he's a very clear aesthetic as well in it.
How would you describe that aesthetic?
A very distilled, pared back. I think his prose are quite pared back. And the world that he creates that these characters exist in, like, it's not a realistic world at all. It's quite an allegorical world. And I thought that was really interesting. But then there's a really profound story at the heart of it, I thought, which is Simon and the boy and the mother as well of the child, Inez. So, and I had kids, my kids were quite young at the time. So I was drawn to the questions and provocations that it brings up as a parent, as well as the bigger questions.
Yeah, I suppose in rough terms, David, who's the young boy character involved, who Simon effectively takes on and adopts. He's about five in the first novel
when
he arrives on this no villa, as it's called.
Yeah.
No villa, no name, no nothing.
Yeah.
Then in the next novel, The School Days, he's in this dance academy. He's a couple of years older.
Yeah.
And then he's about 9 or 10
yes.
as the final novel comes along. We'll come back to why it's the Jesus trilogy.
Sure.
and you're talking about the allegorical elements of it as well. But for you, Fergal, it essentially is. It is like a father-son relationship, or how would you describe it?
Absolutely. And that's something I think I was very drawn to when I read it. Because I hadn't read the novels before I read the script. So I devoured the novels leading up to rehearsals. So I got to the script first, and it really, really struck me, the fatherhood element of it. Mm. It struck a chord, because I'm my wee fella's 11 now, and I was very drawn to that and how it's dealt with, and it's allowing Simon to feel those things, and the panic and the doubt and to hear that from the father's perspective, I found really interesting and really strong, because it's dealt with so well. It's really, he goes right in there, and Simon's very, very flawed. He's allowed to be flawed. He's searching, and he's not getting it right, and he's running away from it, but he keeps getting drawn back because he can't help himself, because I think he deeply loves the boy.
And the relationship does change, and it goes through various phases throughout, across the trilogy.
Hugely.
But David wouldn't be the easiest child in the world to love, would he?
Well, I think he's an easy child to love, but I think he's challenging to parent. I'm not going to say you can't love him. I think he's challenging, because there's an otherness to him, which I think is kind of this magical sense in the novels and in the play. The child challenges in a way that they're not used to children challenging. And I think they've given a voice to the child that is other and is kind of beyond his years, the question he's asking. And he's asking questions in innocence. And I think from that innocence, profound questions are born.
Yeah, he's ultimately asking all the big existential questions.
Huge, from a child's perspective. So there's a real kind of clarity to his asking, why is this like this? And then the adults are going, they can't get away with because it is.
Because I said so.
They're forced to think about what it is as well. Mm. And I think that's challenging. And that makes it very difficult for Simon, who's also going through his own challenges of trying to exist in this new world that he has walked into as well.
Owen
Quinn,
exactly. And he was saying, when we were doing table work around the table, that the boy is not allowed to philosophise, you know, so the boy is kind of told to shut up while the parents give themselves time to think and reflect and philosophise, which is quite interesting, I think.
Yeah.
But I think the child very much becomes burdened, you know, like with lots of different narratives and stories that the adults within the play load onto the child. Basically.
Yeah, even if you say, looking at the situation in the first novel, The Childhood of Jesus, where Simon and David arrive at this place off a boat, you know, we
sent to a camp.
Yeah,
yeah.
So there are real reflections of current day
huge
refugee situations all around the globe. How is that? Did that play in any way to your decision to do it at this time? I mean, obviously, it's something you've been thinking about. But how has it affected what you're showing on stage?
Yeah, like I suppose what I thought was interesting in terms of, you know, the things it's talking about as well is that sense of, because it's a world that people's memory are meant to be wiped clean.
They've no name when they arrive.
They have no name, and then they're given a name, Simon, and he's given an age, and the boy is given a name and an age. And it's they're arriving into a society that supposedly is, you're given everything that you require, given everything that you need. But you could then say it's quite anodyne because it doesn't give it any more. And there's a fear of expression or individuality or passion or love that might be sexual love. And so you're going, this is a society that in order to keep control has to rid itself of any impulses that may feel natural. Now, what Simon's also bringing is the question of, well, what is natural in terms of it's natural to go to the loo, but is it natural for a woman to want me, for example, or is it natural? So those questions of a white middle-aged man coming into a world, and it's kind of looking at what is this society trying to shut out?
Yeah.
What did they not address? And this notion of we're all moving forward, but not really addressing things that have happened in the past. And Simon is going, well, my memory, I still have trace memory of things.
Because the memory is supposed to be wiped effectively. Yeah.
Exactly. So
but
in a way it
talks... ghosts of memories in Simon, and he's carrying a baggage of the past that he can't quite articulate.
There is something, and it's very much five-year-old boy stuff, isn't it? Whatever about the no sex thing, which is obviously there's no sex in this first part of the trilogy.
Yeah.
There's very little poo, which is not suitable for a 5-year old boy at all, who loves to talk about poo endlessly.
Absolutely. He notices that the horse poos everywhere, and then he himself needs a poo, which I tell him that's okay, that's natural, and we'll do it at home in a civilized way. But yeah, and those are the little things that are filtered in that. When I was saying about, you know, from a child's perspective, the stuff that has been taken out of society and taken out of in the place they end up in, what has gotten rid of, the child is saying, but what about this and what about this? And suddenly they're going, well, we have to face this again now.
Yeah, we have
but,
to.
But we don't. And I think the thing is that all this has been wiped out, but the people, especially Simon, they haven't been given the facility to deal with the absence of it. And I think Simon finds that really challenging because the people he encounters are going, well, we just don't do that anymore.
Yeah. Can you just
and
drop
he's
it?
Like, yeah, but why don't we do it? And what do we do instead? Is this all we do?
And I think that speaks to kind of the relevance of what is it that we are missing? So am I missing meat? This is a vegetarian world. Am I missing sex? Am I missing what it means to nurture a child?
Yeah.
Am I missing authority? Am I missing? So it goes into much darker territories.
And the fact,
what is it that you're driving?
And the fact that Coetzee puts in that calls this, you know, the childhood of Jesus, the school days of Jesus, the death of Jesus.
Yeah.
Is there a reference here to religion in general and Christianity specifically?
I suppose Christianity through the title, there is no sense within the world of the play that a God exists even. But more that sense of, say, in a world without religion, what do we look for? Or when I say world without religion, or the influences of religion, you know, and even worlds that have been colonized and influenced in their thinking about how men see women in society, what imprint has that made on people? And also then, what do we look for? So do we look for meaning through art, through dance, through authoritarian regimes, so what are we looking for and craving in our worlds?
And clearly from the way you've both been speaking about it, we can see that there, you know, there are big ideas being discussed here, which is very much in some ways the world of a novel. Not that theatre is bereft of ideas either.
Yeah.
But the challenge of taking that very discursive prose onto the stage must have been quite huge. How have you done that? Are there two choruses involved here?
It's one chorus.
One chorus.
Yeah, so the cast is a chorus, bar Fergal, who's playing Simon. So there's a cast, in a chorus of six, and then they become different characters. But as the play develops, that we do away with the chorus. So we kind of liked the idea, a bit like, I suppose, with the Odyssey or something, that stories get narrated and they get told, and people tell different versions of it and they get handed down. But once something gets put down in writing, then that story becomes more absolute, and it becomes, this is a form of history, and then this has meaning. So in the book, the book that has meaning is Don Quixote. So it's not the Bible. So Don Quixote takes on this mythic status. So it's when, so there's a journey towards something being spoken to something being written, actually.
And the fact that in the school days of Jesus, and you've mentioned that, you know, in that case, we find David, the young boy, is in a dance academy. Mm. Does dance start to play a big part in the production in that middle section?
Yeah, when I read the second book, I remember I live quite close to the choreographer, Megan Kennedy, and I just said, I think I have an idea for something. And then it was like a few years later, I approached her and said, would you work on this with me? So Megan is the choreographer of the show, and she is working with a group of young children. So we have 10 young children. So five will alternate, so five children one night and five the other night. And so we will get their dances within the piece in the second half. And then the children also will take part in the third part of the act as well.
Yeah, when it comes into the death of Jesus.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
We kind of look at the otherness of that as well, because when in the dance academy, you have Simon going, I don't get any of this. Mm. I can't make head nor tail of it. I don't understand what's going on. So the it's not that it's just understood now that this is the way we express ourselves. Simon is the voice of, I don't get this. And I think that's really strong in the play, and really important that we allow that voice in.
The everyman voice.
Yeah,
in some
exactly.
Ways.
Yeah.
Where are you in rehearsals at the moment? Or have you?
We're in beginning of week four. So we have another this week and next week to rehearse.
I'm in such denial. I don't like to hear dates. I'm in denial.
Sorry about that, Farrell.
It's never happening. We're never leaving the rehearsal.
Thought I'd bring it up to you. I'm going to tell you all the dates.
Oh, good.
I'll
just be in the corner here.
Get those lines down. The Jesus Trilogy by J.M. Coetzee is what we've been speaking about. It's adapted by Owen Quinn. Previews at the Mermaid Arts Centre in Bray in County Wicklow on the 4th.
I'll be there.
Of October. Opening night then at the Project Arts Centre on the 9th, and it's there through until the 19th as part of the Dublin Theatre Festival. It's produced by Hatch Theatre Company, Once Off Productions and the Mermaid in Bray, and you can find out full details on dublintheatrefestival.ie, and that's our lot for this Tuesday evening. Research this evening was by Paula Shields and Leah Murphy. Ollie Hamilton was the broadcast coordinator. Tommy O'Sullivan was on sound. And tonight's programme was produced by Pauline McNamara. Back with you tomorrow night, 7 o'clock, here on RT Radio 1. John Crean will be with you after the news.